Welcome to another episode of Old School Guns. This is episode number 28, as I can tell, which is great. As always, we are beholding to no one. No one pulls our strings, and we are completely independent. And if you like what you hear, go ahead and hit the follower button, and you'll get advanced word when our next episode posts. You'll get a little alert, and that's always good because that lets you know. I follow several podcasts, and they really help me when something new is new and out there. I really like that there's a reminder. So if I have a few extra hours or some extra time, I can dial in and hear the latest. Well, let's get right into it. I want to start this cast with a plea for common sense. As you know, if you listen to my earlier casts, I was very critical of some of the NRA's practices that came out of the annual meetings. I mean, it was clearly there was some confusion and there was some disruption in how things worked. And what I want to tell people now is, you know, none of that matters. That's just background noise. The real problem we face now is an existential challenge to our Second Amendment rights. As I said in the last podcast, they are coming for your guns, and that's merely one of the steps they're taking to secure your other freedom and deny you other freedom as well. This is an existential threat to your right to own a firearm and protect yourself. You know, they talked a little bit about an assault weapon ban, but, you know, they're talking about making guns illegal, total confiscation, confiscating and then, you know, compensating you somehow, I guess through some sort of a buyback program, which, you know, would never compensate you even for the material loss, much less the sentimental and other losses that it would be. There isn't enough money that can replace some of the guns you have and some of the memories they invoke and the freedom that they represent. You simply cannot give that up. These people definitely want to take it all, and they see an opportunity. And they're using the graves of the victims of these two shootings as a platform to take away from over 150, maybe 200 million Americans the right to keep and bear arms. It's actually taking it away from all of us, but there's probably just that many that choose to exercise it. So this is very serious indeed, and we've not faced a threat like this really since those horrible days in 1993 when they were crafting the assault weapon ban, and you know, with just the idea of taking it away. And they know that ban didn't work. It didn't lower crime or anything else. It just took guns away from people who could legally possess them previously. Same thing with all the California. California is the biggest, most egregious example, but other states have done the same thing. And it's just denied their law-abiding citizens the right to have a rifle that looks like an AR-15 or an AK-47. It's not those rifles, but they're rifles that look like that and form as semi-automatic rifles, which have been around for well over 100 years, since the early 1900s. This is an ugly and evil power grab by people who don't believe in the fundamental tenets of America, the Constitution of the United States, the Declaration of Independence. They don't believe in any of that. And if you doubt that at all, just look at the socialist programs they tout. Look at the destruction of monuments. And we're not talking just of Confederate monuments. We're talking all kinds of war monuments have been desecrated and destroyed. I talked about the William Lee statue. Has nothing to do with Robert E. Lee. He was the father of the U.S. Airborne Parachute Forces in World War II, and his statue was desecrated. They've had statues of Lincoln desecrated, for Christ's sake. These are hardcore socialists who have gotten into an unholy alliance with some very, very radicalized and very, very politically twisted people who represent some identity politic groups. And, you know, you just go to the squad, and we all know who those members are, and look who they represent, and look at the beliefs they espouse, and you'll see that. But, you know, Bernie Sanders wants to take all your money away. They all want to take something from you, and they're going to start with your gun rights. They're going to start taking, and they're not going to stop. And only we can stop them. And the best way as gun owners we can stop them is by supporting our pro-Second Amendment organizations. And you do that by joining your state rifle association or rifle and pistol association. You do that by joining the National Rifle Association. You do that by joining the other groups that you want to support. And there's a list of smaller groups out there. I hope that they do great, and I hope that they're effective. But for my money, the bang for the buck is the 5 million member NRA. It still has incredible clout. It is a formidable and effective organization. And I've talked a lot about these guys who have a grudge against it and aren't going to donate money. Oh, and this is all a bunch of nonsense too. Not one penny until, you know, this happens or that happens. Hey, forget it. We don't have time for that now. That is small ball. That is absolutely does not matter. What matters is our Second Amendment rights, and we have to mobilize every tool and every organization, everything at our disposal to preserve it. Because, you know, when they passed the assault weapon ban in 1994, it had a sunset clause. Don't think that they're going to make that mistake again. Don't think that they're going to allow us to restore rights. They're not. Once they take these things, they're going to be gone. And you know, you're never going to get your guns back. They're talking total confiscation, and they're not just going to put them in a warehouse waiting for a law to expire. They will destroy them. They're coming for those things. They're coming for your guns. They're coming for your ammunition. They will legislate you either completely out, or they will do the death by a thousand cuts, where you can't have more than 50 rounds of ammunition without a special license, or doing as they are trying to attempt to do in California, have a background check to buy ammo. I mean, they can price, there's a lot of different weapons they can use. They can price you out of the market by making it so expensive you can't afford to shoot anymore and you have to do something else. They can legislate you out of the market by just absolutely taking everything away, even stuff that you bought that was previously legal. And, you know, they're not going to grandfather anybody. They're coming for it. They can also just do a total prohibition, and anybody found with a gun will be a felon and get a mandatory 10-year prison sentence or some other draconian punishment. There's no way out of this except legislatively fighting, and the NRA is at the forefront of this. You can criticize them for past moves, but that's not going to get you your gun rights. That doesn't get you a buy. That doesn't get you anything. And to these people who've said, I'm not going to donate another penny until something happens, hey, you got to get on board or else you're going to have nothing. You're going to have less than nothing. So we've got to use the tools we have. I myself think the NRA is a great organization, and it's got a lot of great people in it. Have mistakes been made? Yeah, probably so. Every organization makes mistakes. But we can't afford to turn our backs on it now. We have to be part of the 5 million, hopefully 5 million plus. We should be signing up new members. The gun club I'm a member of currently requires you to be an NRA member. We should be doing that with almost all of our gun clubs. We need the members. We need the people. We need the voices. We need the people working out in the communities, calling their legislatures, organizing. The more we show, the better off we'll be. And I mean, I think gun owners have given up a lot already this year. We gave up bump stocks. I personally have no use for bump stocks, and I don't like bump stocks. But we never should have given them away without getting something in return. And I think that we have to learn now. The bump stock ban It didn't satiate anybody. There's nobody saying, well, you know, this year we've already gotten bump stocks, so let's just stop. No, every incident that comes up, they use that even before the smoke is cleared, even before people have been buried, even before we know the identity of the perpetrator, they're calling for gun control. I mean, it's sick, it's twisted, it's perverted. And it's just because they're targeting you. They're targeting you, they're targeting me, they're targeting anybody who owns a firearm. They don't like them, and they want them gone. And they're willing to do anything to do that. And I see where the Democratic Party, one of the headlines was, Democratic Party is united behind gun control. Well, then I hope we crush them at the polls. We'll need to. And we'll need to get everybody out. Even the guy who says, I don't like voting, or I don't like this person, I don't like that person. You got to vote for all the pro-gun people there, whether you really care for them or not. It starts at the top of the ticket and goes all the way down. That will send a message to our representatives in Washington that, hey, we are out here, we are in significant numbers, and we will not put up with this. It's either that or the dark ages are coming. And if you want to live in a highly regulated, horrible environment, then let these people have their way. And you know what? And whatever they propose, whatever they get by, will not stop mass murder. It will not stop terrorism murder, no matter who perpetrates it. One of the sickest things in the media is they always want to attribute this to a group. Well, you know, this person was a white nationalist, or this person was something else. But when it's a leftist or socialist, like the shooter in Dayton was, well, they don't really want to point that out. But it doesn't matter. Terrorism is terrorism, and it has to be stopped. And the way to stop it is with having common sense security measures, also having some ability for family members to control an out-of-control family member or somebody who constitutes a threat. And we're not talking about these red flag laws. These are nothing more than a canard that's being used to deprive people of their rights, where somebody doesn't like what I post on Facebook, and they're in California, and I'm on the other side of the country. They can somehow call the cops under red flag laws and get my weapons confiscated. No, that's not what we're talking about. That kind of stuff is never going to work. And again, they always like to put these broad labels on. It goes back to common sense gun control and red flag laws and all this. What are the specifics? What do these things actually mean? And no one really wants to define that. Of course, you know, we know what Congress did with Obamacare. Somebody crafted a bill and none of them even read it. Pelosi's famous comment was, we have to pass it so we know what's inside it. It's insanity. They'll do the same thing with gun control. How many gun control laws, and I can think back time and time again, where a gun control law that's designed to do one thing winds up basically being co-opted and written in such a way that it makes attempts to make something else completely illegal, you know? And so, like, you know, they always used to do this, all these, when they would try these Saturday night special laws. There's a term you haven't heard in a while. But these Saturday night special laws, and it turns out that it makes every handgun illegal because of the way they write the technical definitions inside the law. But most people on the surface think, well, this will just make Saturday night specials illegal. No, it's going to make everything illegal. Don't fall for it. Just don't fall for it. Even if you're at work or some place where you can have an honest conversation, and I'm not saying being a rabble-rouser, but when you hear misinformation, do your best to respectfully correct it, because a lot of people don't know. They just simply don't know the difference between an AR-15 and an M-16. They don't know the difference because they're not gun people. And when you explain the differences and explain how things are controlled, you know, I think they'll get a much better sense of what's going on. Be a good representative of the gun community. That's probably the best advice I can give anybody. But the other thing we have to do is legislatively, we have to support the NRA. We have to support it. You want to support other people in addition to that, that's fine. But you have to support the NRA. We're all in the same boat. And basically, undermining or undercutting or carping about the NRA, all that's doing is giving them, is emboldening our enemies, because they hear that the NRA is all goofed up and they're going for it. One of the things they feared in the past was the NRA and the unity it can generate among gun owners. Well, if they think that's gone, believe me, a lot of these people that have been sitting on the fence or have been cowering in the background, they're going to become emboldened. And what they want is in your gun safe. What they want is in your holster. What they want is what defends your family. When you're not home and your significant other has to defend the kids and the castle with a shotgun, a rifle, or a pistol, that's what they want. They want you to have nothing except maybe a phone where you can call 911 and, you know, everything will be over by the time the police get there. It just will be. So they want your means to defend yourself. They want your means to hunt and enjoy the outdoors. They want your means to enjoy competition, enjoy history, and partake in a lifestyle of which they just simply don't approve. They simply don't approve of it. So, you know, the choice is very clear. The choice is cut and dry. And you have to make that choice. You have to go out and say, I'm going to stand for something. I'm going to stand with the NRA. I'm going to stand with the pro-Second Amendment people. And we are not going to let this happen. We're not going to let this pass. We are going to stand up. We are going to defend ourselves. We're going to do it in the courts. We're going to do it in the ballot box. We're going to do it by letting our elected officials know exactly where we stand. We're going to do it. And that's what has to be done. And if you don't, you know, I'm sad to say, but you can go look at your favorite gun right now and kiss it goodbye, because it isn't going to be around, because they want them all. They don't want some. They want them all. That brings us to our next piece of interesting news. Apparently, Universal Pictures made a film, and they were in the process of promoting it. It was called The Hunt. And the premise of The Hunt is that deplorables, i.e. Trump supporters, Republicans, I'm sure firearms owners would be a big part of this, would be captured and taken to an estate or some sort of an area where they could be hunted by rich liberals. Okay, you know, this is a psychotic, twisted fantasy. I don't quite understand how anybody could be so demented as to put something like that out. It's clearly politically charged. It's clearly, you know, something meant as some sort of a warning or message to people who don't agree with them. They're looking definitely for, you know, it's a warning, and it's saying that we're going to come get you, we're going to exterminate you. I realize there was a Jules Verne story called The Island. I believe it was The Island, where, you know, something similar to that was happening, where, you know, people would get hunted on an island. But this is got the political aspect to this, and it has the thought that these elites who, you know, will tell you that they know better than you and I, they're just going to come after you and they can hunt you and all the rest of this, and there's nothing you can really do about it. I don't know. Again, it's a sick, twisted, demented fantasy that's been conjured up by the really sick minds of Hollywood. And the latest word is, well, they're debating whether they're going to release the film or if they're going to delay it or cancel it altogether. because of the two recent mass shootings. Well, that's a bunch of bunk. The reason that they are going to delay or cancel that movie is because a backlash that they do not want to withstand. And they know that if they release something like that, that people are going to see it for what it is. And it's going to just make their agenda a little too accessible, a little too out in the open. So that's why they're probably not going to release that. But the fact that they would make that fits in with a lot of left socialist type of violence. Now, we've had Biden, Booker talk about beating up the president, something that's really, you know, childish and foul. We've had Kathy Griffin run around with her latex head that looks like Trump. There's been, you know, little, you know, pipsqueaky docudrama type movies made about assassinating Trump. There was one way back about assassinating George W. Bush and all the rest of it. This stuff is out there. You know, they are inciting. That's the kind of stuff that keeps Antifa going and all the rest of this. They're trying to normalize this kind of violence, and that is a very, very bad thing. You know, America will be a very unsafe place for everyone if the influencers, the people who help shape public opinion or influence a large number of people out in the public, if they keep peddling this kind of tripe and this kind of garbage and emboldening people to take violent actions, it's going to happen. And no one should do that. No one should do that. Even in a politically polarized and charged society, that should not be allowed to happen. But yet here we are. Used to be if you made a threat against the President of the United States, and I don't care if it's George W. Bush or Barack Obama or any other president, you got a little visit from the FBI. And I think Kathy Griffin got one, and it wasn't very pleasant. They didn't buy off on her bullshit story that, you know, she's just an entertainer and this is all satire. That's what they want to hide behind. They called this movie The Hunt a satire. Well, I'm sorry, it's not a satire. It's what they actually believe. And it's really reprehensible. It's really reprehensible. So we've got to be on guard. This is a very unusual time. And until this 2020 election is over, I think it's going to get worse, and it's going to get exponentially worse. The rhetoric, the actions, and some of the stuff that goes on. But right now, we have got to get behind gun rights. For now, I would say probably for the next 2 years, gun rights are going to be the most important issue that really faces the country. And this is the deal. We're either going to be a free people or we're not. So be very wary of what's going to be on television, what's going to be on the radio waves and the internet and everything else, because clearly they've taken the gloves. If they'll produce trash like The Hunt, who knows what will come out next. Well, getting into a little bit better territory here, it appears that InRange TV put out a good video, and I think they did some hard work, and they kind of returned to some of the more serious and analytical stuff, which they've done a very good job with in the past. But I'm speaking specifically about the mud test for the HK416 clone that they put together. And of course, it's a one-off test, so it's anecdotal. It's not scientific. It used a lower which was not an HK lower, so that's not an issue. And they made that very, very plain. They were really looking to see how mud, and again, their mud's a little different than anybody else's because they're in Arizona, and it's a little more sandy and pebbly probably than mud you would find in a swamp in Louisiana or red clay that you would find at Fort Benning, Georgia. But be that as it may, as a one-off test, it was interesting. Their conclusion was that basically in a standardized as much as possible test, that the direct impingement ARs do very, very well, and other guns are not performing nearly as well. And they've gone through the AKs and the M1 rifle, the M14, and a whole host of others. And most normally, they perform with just a couple of shots after really being mudded, you know, 1 to 2 shots. And then they lock up or they experience a malfunction whereby the weapon has to be completely field stripped and cleaned and to be put back in operation. This one was no exception. I think the expectation of the viewers were that it would perform as well as the direct impingement ARs, and it flatly does not. It behaved more like the AKs and the other ones, where it just fired a few shots after being mudded. It would fire a shot here, a shot there, maybe 2 shots, and then a jam that had to be cleared pretty significantly. So it was, you know, it was nice to see that. I guess I'm surprised. I thought that the gas piston system would be much more immune from crud. I kind of wonder, do the manufacturers do some of this testing themselves? I mean, it isn't very hard to do. It appears it would only take about 15 minutes. And, you know, if I had a standard AR-15 and they did an SP-1, and it seems to outperform the HK-416 clone, and I emphasize clone. If I were HK, I'd probably be looking at that going, what can we do to make these rifles perform a little better? And, you know, frankly, I think direct impingement's the way to go. I've always thought that. They're, in my mind, everybody always hides, well, you really want a piston gun for reliability. Well, we find out that that's not true. Then it's, well, you want a piston gun because it's better in fully automatic fire. And while somebody may say that's true, I don't think there's anything wrong with an M16 or an M4 in fully automatic fire, other than it heats up quickly. And like any fully automatic weapon, it becomes more difficult to control, and therefore they mitigated that with the burst. Some people like it, some people don't. So I look at that, and then the next thing is, well, an adjustable gas system lets you shoot this suppressed without the overgassing of the system and all this other nonsense, which I'm sure is probably true. And maybe if you're going to shoot suppressed all the time, maybe a piston is the way to go. But I just kind of look at it and go, it's the old Jeff Cooper quote keeps popping into my head with when I see the latest AR-15 piston gun, and that is, hey, it's an ingenious solution to a non-existent problem. It seems to add a lot of complexity. It seems to add what really are more points of failure, and it seems to add a vulnerability that the DI guns, direct impingement guns, just don't seem to have. So why would you want it? I think the last one, which is the silencer issue, is, well, and shooting suppressed is, you know, does that happen as much as people think? And I'd also like to know, how are these things? The U.S. military's got some of these things kicking around. I think the SEALs have some. Maybe the Marines have some. You know, how are they performing? I will be willing to wager that they don't really fire suppressed very often, so that doesn't really matter. And they're kept probably clean like all infantry or military rifles should be, so I'm betting that they perform very, very well, and there's probably no discernible difference between the piston gun and the DI gun. Therefore, the question is, well, why do I need it? And the answer may be that sometimes something different has an allure all of its own, has a magic and a quality all of its own. So that's the only thing I can think of. Oh, by the way, speaking of ARs, I think in the last cast I called the Brownells a proto-AR that I've been firing and been experimenting with. I think I called that the retro-AR, but it is actually the proto-AR that has the trigger charging handle on top. So when you hear me say retro-AR with the trigger charging handle, that's the one I'm talking about, the proto-AR. I realize it's part of the retro line, and the retro line is really impressive. I mean, Brownells has done a brilliant job with that. I really, my hat's off to them. I think that's, if they would turn out a retro AR-180, that would be such a cool product line, because those were just great rifles. And I think it'd be just first rate, actually. I really don't want to see them with the modern enhancements. I want to see them the way they were. The only concession I would make to modernity would be have the AR-180 clone take M16 magazines, standard AR-15 magazines. That way you don't have to have a second or different set of magazines if you already have an AR. And that could even be facilitated by having maybe two lower options, one that would take an original magazine and one that would take an M16 magazine. But it would be a great addition to their retro line, and it would really kind of fill it out. I mean, they could still come out with some different variations of the very excellent AR-10 they're making, but I really think they've got the AR-15 and the early variants, the semi-automatic versions of the M16 really covered well. And if you like them, buy them now, because they're out there, they're here, and get them. Just go ahead and get them. If you got any doubt in your mind, erase it and go ahead and grab one of these, because they really look great. And I'm at the point where I don't need any other ones, but I do love that XM16E1. I qualified on one of those, and it was a great rifle, and I really liked how different it was. It really felt great, and it didn't really feel that much different than the M16A1, but it was definitely a cool rifle, and it was very easy to get the magazine out because it did not have the fence around it. So a very, very cool rifle, and a very unique opportunity has been given to us by Brownells to own something that you've only seen in books. I think I've seen one AR-10, original AR-10, and the rest I've seen are in books. And same thing with the Proto AR. I've only seen that in books, and now I'm actually able to pull the trigger on one. It's a clone, it's a copy, but you know what? It's really a fun rifle, and it's really a great piece of history. If you appreciate that, it's really, really an excellent product. Okay, let's get to the question and answer, my favorite part of the podcast. And first of all, we're not going to talk about bear attacks, except to say that two friends of mine, one of them a very good friend of the podcast, he was in Yellowstone, and he texted me a picture of two brown bears heading towards him. And he goes, well, this is as close as we got to them. I guess he went back into his car, and they drove away before the bears could pursue. And the other one is a work colleague of mine. He has a cabin in Colorado, and his wife and daughter-in-law are up there, and they're waiting for the other family members, and he was following up in like a week after them. So he showed me a picture. There's actually a younger grizzly, looks like. It's a brown bear, and it's been trying to get its way into the house, and his wife has got a pistol and a shotgun. The last I saw of my friend, he was throwing stuff in his car, and he had an M1 rifle, and he was going to head to the cabin. So if there's a problem up there, I'm sure he'll be able to handle it. He's pretty pretty resourceful guy, and he knows how to use the weapons he's got. So anyway, we're not going to talk about bear attacks, though. So question we have is, if the U.S. model 1917 rifle was so good and performed so well in World War I, why was it not retained in service and just kept after the war as the standard issue rifle for American soldiers? And that's a very, very good question, because I've talked about that, how good a rifle it is, and how, in my opinion, it's superior to the Springfield. And we've kind of touched on this in a couple of the earlier casts, but I'll go ahead and kind of give it a little bit different perspective. The first thing was, it was a great rifle and it performed brilliantly, but it didn't conform to what the Army really wanted in a rifle, which was, since the 1880s, the Army had rifles that had fully adjustable rear sights, the Buffington sight. And that's even the one you see on the 19 03 Springfield. I think they call it the Model 1905 site on that. And earlier ones, they call it the Buffington site. Buffington was the name of the officer that designed it. You know, it's a fully adjustable sight, and it has a peep sight and a ladder, and it's got a few other ways to aim. And if you fold the ladder down, there's a 425-yard battle sight there. So it's a very effective sight. It is very challenging to use the peep sight because it's about 6 inches away from your eye, and it's very, very small. And that would not be a great sight in combat. But that was the sight they wanted, and it was on the rifle they wanted. And, you know, it was developed at Springfield Armory. And here's an important point. We didn't have to pay anybody for it. We were paying the Germans because we used the same magazine charging or stripper clip system that was actually a German thing. And they want a lawsuit against us. World War One happens. Hey, that's all out the door. So we don't have to pay the Germans anything anymore on the Mauser system that we used. So we had this rifle. And we owned the rights to it. We could produce them at government arsenals or armories, and there we go. You know, it's ours. We have it. So that was a big factor. The next factor was the Model 1917 was originally a British design. The P14, it started the P13, which had a 276 cartridge, high-speed cartridge. This all came out of the Boer War, where the Lee Enfield was outranged by some of the 7mm Mauser rifles. So essentially the British designed a Mauser style rifle, smaller caliber flat trajectory rifle of their own, basically matching the experience that they had in the Boer War. World War One comes along, and of course the Lee Enfield performs brilliantly in the trenches, and the distances aren't that great, so as they were in the Boer War. So the British stick with the Lee Enfield, but we were producing the other rifle, the P14, which was the same rifle except in 303 British. We were producing that in large quantity, produced like 1.2 million or something of those for the British, and those factories were already set up. It was a great stroke of engineering and a great stroke of genius and a great stroke of luck that just by rechambering that rifle to 30-06, we came up with a really excellent, very excellent battle rifle. So, but it was a British design, and at the end of World War One, the British owed us a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money. They bought a lot of munitions and stuff from us. They owed us a lot of money. And there was a fear that if we adopted the 1917 and kept it in production and kept using it, that the British would ask for an offset of some of the money that they owed us. And they just, U.S. government just wasn't interested in that. It's like, okay, we used it during the war. We're not going to use it. We're not going to incur a potential liability to the British. This is, after all, their design, and they didn't want to get into the same situation that they'd been in with Mauser, where we developed something, and all of a sudden you're being, you know, kind of in some international court, and there's a judgment against you, and you got to pay royalties to somebody else. They didn't want any part of that. The third part was they didn't produce the 1917 rifles in government arsenals or government armories. It was produced in private factories, and it had a private factory workforce. They weren't government employees that, you know, you hire and they work for you, and they're really not in unions or anything. And there was a lot of labor problems at the end of World War One. And they were afraid that, hey, you know, if we outsource our rifle production, because the government wasn't going to buy all this tooling, you know, they weren't just going to do that. And they weren't going to retool Springfield Armory to make these with factories already set up and basically the production lines ready to go. You know, the problem was they said, we don't want to outsource our rifle production. At that time, they didn't want to do that. Now, 50 years later, Springfield Armory closes because the government's not happy with them. But at that time, they were the government arsenal. They produced things. And, you know, they weren't And again, given the experience they had with handguns of, hey, Colt can't produce enough, then we have to ask Smith & Wesson, and then, you know, we're reliant on these outside vendors. That was not something the government was into. The last reason it was not adopted, and probably the most important, and it ties back to what we were saying at the beginning, it was not what the Army really wanted in a rifle by not having a fully adjustable rear sight. So the National Match Course was not changed to accommodate the 1917. So in 1919, they do the National Matches, you know, starting them up after the war. And it's a problem because the 1917 does not perform well because you can't adjust the sight. You just sort of have to Kentucky windage it by using the, you know, the front sight. It was very thick anyway compared to the Springfield. So it's harder to Kentucky windage to get a really high score. Yeah, you can hit the target, but you're not going to hit those high scores that you can by putting the fine adjustment on the rear of the Springfield sight. So these things created real problems. They created real problems. And nobody really wanted to use the 1917. So it went into stores. It went into the, by stores, I mean storage, not commercial stores. But it went into military stores. They were stored. Some were given out to the National Guard. Over the years, a few were sold to military, foreign military governments, like the Philippines. Even though they were a U.S. protectorate, they had their own version of a land army, and you know they were through some foreign military, you know, sales credit type deal. They were equipped with 1917 rifles. And in World War II, of course, they were brought out and used predominantly for training. And, you know, it did very well. And plus, they were given to the Free French, who didn't like them because they thought they were getting kind of the old junk, even though they were actually getting a very good rifle. But anyway, so that's the 1917 was just not going to get adopted because it didn't do particularly well on the National Match Course, and you couldn't compensate for the various wind conditions with the rear sight it had. So all those things together doomed the 1917. And it basically ensured that the 1903 and later the 1903A1, which had the pistol grip stock and was a lot more comfortable to shoot, and later the 1903A3, which was a kind of a substitute standard in World War II, that rifle would be continued in service and continue to be used, and the 1917 would essentially vanish from the U.S. military at the end of World War II. I think it was declared a completely obsolete instead of obsolescent or substitute standard or whatever it was. It was completely washed out of the system, and therefore, you know, thousands of them were sold to sportsmen and shooters and everything. Some were sporterized, some, thankfully, many were kept in original condition, and those are the ones we really prize and enjoy today. But it has to do, now, had the National Match Course been changed so that it would have been maybe closer range, more rapid fire, maybe with stringent times, things that the 1917 would be better at than the 1903, then there might have been at least some argument for a different decision. But as it was, there was no reason to make it the standard military rifle. The next question came from a colleague at work, and here it is. And I'm can't wait to get my teeth into this one. For home defense, why would you need a rifle that has a 30-shot magazine? And I will tell you, here's my viewpoint on that. Number one, there was just a case where there were four guys in a home invasion broke in on a kind of an older person, not old and feeble, but a person who was a little bit older. And he shot and killed three of them with an AR-15 rifle. You know, it's almost impossible to do that with any other kind of of weapon. You get the quick follow-up shot. You have a great supply of ammunition, and you can concentrate on engaging targets. And the other thing is you don't have to worry about reloading. And that brings me to my next point. There are people who don't reload rifles quickly or well. And I'm talking inexperienced shooters. And you can sometimes a spouse can fall into this category, or they can operate the weapon just fine, but a quick magazine change is a skill that they may not have. So therefore, having a 30-shot capacity is it, even if that's three times, four times as much as they would ever need, is a good thing to have. They don't have to reload the gun, and they have enough ammunition to cover any contingency. They're not going to go there and blaze through 30 rounds. The same thing kind of holds true for a Glock or any kind of high-capacity pistol. If you've got 17 rounds in it, you probably aren't going to have to reload. You just probably aren't if you're defending your home. You're not out solving crimes. You're not out doing this. You're just in the home. People have broken through the perimeter of your home. They're inside. They're going to do you harm. Having that 30-round capacity is perfect. The same reason anybody else would want it if they're in law enforcement, the military, anything else. It's just a great capability to have. It just is. And you can make the deal, well, they should know how to do it in case it malfunctions or whatever else. That's just not probably not going to be the case. Somebody can pick it up and they can shoot. The less experienced people who can handle the firearm but aren't great on magazine changes and all the rest of it, that is a great weapon to have. So that's why it's important. And that's why, to go back to the beginning of the podcast, it's important to protect our rights, because they want to take anything high capacity away from you. And if six people break in and you've only got four shots, that's too few. But if four people break in, six people break in, and you've got 30 shots, you can hold them off, and you've got a chance to survive. Here's another question, and this came up with the gun control debate. And that is, if I have the right to keep and bear arms, why can't I have grenades and a Stinger missile launcher with a Stinger missile? Why can I have those things if I have the right to keep and bear arms? And I would say that, well, frankly, those things are different because grenades are explosives. They're not a firearm. It's not an arm. You may consider yourself armed with one, but it's not bearing arms. Bearing arms was carrying what was small arms, which are rifles. Small arms are anything that's 50 caliber and below with an inert projectile. That's why things like an M203 grenade launcher, a Stinger missile, a tank round, those are all classified differently and treated differently by the BATFE. And you can actually own those things with a special license, with a special background check. I mean, it would be preposterously expensive, but you can actually own them and do so with the controlled deal. They use them in the movies, and they use things like them in the movies. These things are basically, they're attainable if you have the money and you are willing to get the correct license. But the reason that a hand grenade does not fall under firearms laws is because it's simply not a firearm. It's not a firearm. So it'd be like saying, I'm going to use firearms laws to govern the ownership and use of a Ferrari automobile. Well, it's different. It's not a firearm either. So therefore, that's always a false argument that a lot of gun controllers want to use, which is, well, then why can't I own a tank? Well, because a tank is not a firearm. A tank is a destructive device, and the ammunition falls out of the firearms laws. So if you're talking about firearms laws, you're not talking about a tank. That's something completely different. So a lot of people are saying, well, if you can own an AR-15, that's the same as owning a tank. No, it's not. It's completely different, and it's governed by a completely different set of laws, a completely different set of rules and regulations. Okay, here is another question, and this one's kind of fun. What are your favorite firearms movies? And that's always a, there are too many to list. And I think that there are some just absolutely great ones out there. I have to say one of my favorites for the, to take the Thompson submachine gun, my favorites would have to be Public Enemies with Johnny Depp, even though he's a weirdo, but it is a great movie, and he is scarily like John Dillinger, although the history of it is a little jumbled up, and it doesn't follow the historical timeline exactly. It's still a pretty good one. The other one would be Dillinger, the 1973 with Warren Oates as Dillinger. That's a great one. And I think to round out the Thompsons, I think Sahara with Humphrey Bogart. You know, he's running around with a 1928 vertical foregrip. Very cool, very cool. So I like all of those. Those are absolutely great movies, and the firearms in them are a lot of fun. For Old West firearms, of course, there's Tombstone. I know Lonesome Dove was a mini series, but it was still great. A lot of kind of cap and ball and early Winchester stuff in there. And Augustus McCrae using the Colt Walker. That was a lot of fun. Although I think his was converted to take cartridges. I've heard that was the same gun that was used in True Grit, the original True Grit with John Wayne, but I'm not sure, but I remember reading that in a movie article somewhere. So that's absolutely, those are some of the great ones. Of course, Quigley Down Under, if you like black powder cartridges, that's excellent. So many great World War II and movies that you really, it's very hard to come by. Of course, I'd have to give a shout out to Kelly's Heroes, I think was a fun movie that had a lot of great weapons sequences in it, and as was the much more serious and much more thought-provoking Saving Private Ryan. I think they did an excellent job with that also. Yeah, those are great ones. Trying to think of a world war. Yeah, I think the Rough Riders captured the Spanish-American War pretty well. World War One, I think the Lost Battalion did a good job. It did have some weaknesses, but caught a good job. I especially like the one scene where one of the lieutenants had a 1917 revolver. I thought that was pretty cool. A lot of great movies out there that cover the times. So those are some of my favorite ones. Of course, Good to Bad the Ugly and the A Few Dollars More and A Fistful of Dollars. Those are always very entertaining to watch the gunplay in those. I do like the Clint Eastwood, his single action that has the snake on the grip. I think that's awesome. I actually have a silver snake on. I've got an old Hawes single action that I put the silver snake on. That it looks very cool. I really enjoy that. That's a lot of fun. So anyway, those are a lot of great gun movies. There's probably others that I'm certainly Shooter with Mark Wahlberg has got some great stuff in it. The Jackal with Bruce Willis, you know, that robotic cannon that he built. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff out there that's really great. So those are some of my favorites. If you have favorites, you can always type them in the comments, or you can, that's probably the best place to put them. Type them in the comments and we'll mention them and talk about them. But favorite firearms related movies, definitely. I forgot about the Terminator series too, but definitely put your selections in the comments, because it's always more interesting knowing what the people out who are listening think. So anyway, I know this was a more serious podcast, especially the first part. I hope you take it to heart. I hope that we can definitely make an impact and preserve our rights. And this is Old School Guns. If you do like what you hear, go ahead and hit the follower button. The follower button. I think I've been telling people to hit the like button, but you can hit the follower button too. And that usually looks like a little person, you know, a little head and little shoulders, kind of a stylized thing. So if you hit that, you'll definitely get a notice when the next episode is posted. But until then, this is Old School Guns out.